I think we'll get started. Thank you for coming to this session at the end of a long day. My name is James Flotten, and I teach at the University of Minnesota, and mostly physics and some aerospace, and I'm kind of self-taught in astronomy. I'm not an official astronomer. Some of you may be, and I want to say that I'm not. But I enjoy the pictures, for sure. And so I thought I would take you on what I consider kind of a whirlwind tour. This is not going to be evenly balanced, I'll tell you that right now. An evenly balanced whirlwind tour of the universe would not mention the Earth at all. But we'll start here, and we'll go out from here. So, and then later this week I'll be doing a few other presentations on some on astronomy and spaceflight, and some on physics. So perhaps I'll see some of you. In fact, I should say that you will see, not to bore you, but you will see some of these same images again tomorrow night in Vespers. I would like to think that a discussion of what you're seeing maybe will help you appreciate them more, besides just their beauty, also sort of their background from a science astronomy perspective. So here we go, 60 minutes or less, it will be less. And the reason is, not that the universe doesn't deserve more, but the reason is I do want to save some time at the end. I will probably have some slightly provocative slides at the very end, and then hopefully have a little discussion, and certainly look me up anytime in the village if you'd like to talk about these things. But I think I'm going to run through my slides now without stopping too much, just to make sure we get all the way through. So let's start here on the Earth. This is a photograph taken by a balloon flight that I did out of the University of Minnesota. Over overcast skies above Alexandria, Minnesota, you can see the curvature of the Earth. If you look carefully, you can see the limited nature of our atmosphere. We need to take care of it. And the sun. And in the middle of the daytime, the sky is black once you get above the atmosphere. We're doing an overview, so we're going to start here. And of course, this is even more familiar. I took this picture the first day I arrived, which was last week, Thursday. It turns out that the reason I took the picture was because of the moon. Can't see the moon. Oh well, it turned out okay. I'll show you the next picture is the moon, which is in this picture, you just can't see it. But just a comment about where we live. We live in a very unique place. It's not 100% clear if it's the only place like this, but it's the only place that we know of at all like this. We have an oxygen atmosphere, which is the result of mostly the life on Earth. Okay? And then we have water in liquid form, which is unusual, at least for our solar system. And we have mountains, and we have trees, and we have buildings, and we have people. And there's the moon over copper. And that was in the previous picture, just the contrast was not quite right. So let's proceed on to the moon. We've been there, though not recently. We may go back at some point. It turns out that this may be fairly familiar. This is the moon. This is a very unfamiliar view of the moon, and the reason is as the moon encircles the Earth, it keeps the same face towards us. This is the backside of the moon. And the backside of the moon really looks pretty much hammered up, much more than the front side of the moon, or the near side of the moon. So, and of course, if you are at the moon, you can see the Earth. This picture is often shown with the horizon horizontal, but I've been told by astronauts that I've met that this was in fact the orientation of the spacecraft at the time they took the photograph. Very famous photograph. So, time for us to proceed. Let's talk about the big guy on the block. This is the Sun. Compared to the Earth, I mean, the Earth is just a speck. In fact, here's the Sun with various things. It's a very active place, with prominences and things sticking out. This is actually a photograph of the Sun taken a couple days ago. This is the most recent one I could find. And the size of the Earth, if it were next to the Sun, would be smaller than that. We're not very big compared to the Sun. I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to show you what the Sun looks like at approximately the same date in ultraviolet. The reason this is a cheat is because this is supposed to be a discussion of what you can see in visible. If you want to talk about ultraviolet, come back to my next session on telescopes and we'll do ultraviolet then. So, what I want to do, is I want to escape from this and show you a very quick clip. 30 seconds or so worth of the sun, showing it rotating. Sun goes around every 3 weeks or so. And this is the sun in a fairly active phase, taken from the stereo ahead spacecraft. There's also a stereo behind spacecraft, and you put the two images together and you can get 3D images. So this dates from 2007, and just shows that there's lots and lots going on, and depending on whether you look in the visible or in the X-ray or in the infrared or in the ultraviolet, you'll see different features on the surface of the sun. Here you can see a lot of granulation, indicating a churning surface. Sunspots tend to be indicative of places where there's magnetic fields sticking out of the sun. So I'm going to stop once in a while for a little video clip and then jump back to this presentation. So, of course, although the sun is the big guy in the neighborhood, we are often very interested in the planets. So here's a montage, not to scale, just the planets lined up. You can perhaps name them. We will look at them individually very briefly here. So, closest to the sun is Mercury. Mercury is not too different from our moon, as in no atmosphere, lots of craters. Mercury is a difficult target for spacecraft because it's so small and it's so close to the sun. It's hard to stop when you get that close to the sun, actually. But we just managed to insert a spacecraft in orbit around Mercury recently, a few months ago. The Messenger spacecraft for the first time. So we're getting very good details about Mercury, and it continues to surprise us, as does almost everything we look at. In the visible, Venus is very boring. Venus has 100% cloud cover 100% of the time. You wouldn't want to live there anyway. The temperature on Venus exceeds what you can reach in your oven. You can't turn your oven up high enough to reach the surface temperature of Venus. Venus may at one point in the past have been something like the Earth, perhaps, but things went badly wrong with the atmosphere. And we need to be careful that we don't mess up this planet in the same way. Not that there were people who messed up that planet necessarily, but our influences on our own atmosphere could lead to a greenhouse effect such as Venus is experiencing now. Here is us. If you look closely, you can see us sitting there. No, maybe not there. The United States in view. A couple things you'll notice here, perhaps. One is that land, sticking out of the oceans, is a little bit uncommon. The Earth is much more oceans than it is land. And this blue color, of course, is water. We'll see blue, actually, in a lot of these photographs, but it's often going to be scattered light from gases in an atmosphere, as opposed to, in this case, surface water. And then there's lots and lots of white, not only white for the ice caps, but white for the clouds. And sometimes the Earth, photographs of the Earth, you can't even tell what you're looking at because there's so much cloud cover. This is a relatively clear photograph, in fact. Okay, so here we go. Continuing on, Mars out from the Earth. This is a photograph of Mars taken. I haven't, in fact, documented very well where I took these photographs from. I didn't take very many of them myself, just those first couple. But these are almost all available public domain. Many of them are from big telescopes on the surface of the Earth, and many of them are also from orbiting telescopes such as the Hubble Space Telescope. This is actually a photo, and some of them are from spacecraft that went there. So this one is actually taken from Earth. And you can see the polar ice caps. Mars actually suffers from dust storms. Sometimes the dust storms will encompass the entire planet. But in general, Mars is relatively clear. It has an atmosphere, but it's very thin. Surface atmosphere characteristics of Mars are about the same as 100,000 feet up here. Now, I go there a lot with balloon flights, and so I know what it's like 100,000 feet up, and there's not much there, and that's what Mars is like. So it's very difficult, for instance, to imagine flying any aircraft or balloons or anything like that in the Martian atmosphere. We are planning to land, we as in NASA. I represent NASA for the state of Minnesota. NASA is landing their next rover on Mars within a week. And frankly, you can't slow down a rover well enough with parachutes to land it on the surface. So you have to do something more than that. Some rockets, some airbags, something. So this particular Martian lander, which is about the size of a small car, much bigger than the ones that are currently there, will be landed using a sky crane maneuver where you come in, you slow down with parachutes, and then you actually fire rockets, and you hover above the surface, and you winch the thing down to the surface. Never been tried before. never been tested. I say that because you cannot test the system. You can't test it on the Earth. The gravity's wrong, the density of the air is wrong, everything's wrong. They hope it will work. I hope it will work. We will find out in about a week's time. This is landing, Mars Science Laboratory is landing next Sunday. So, in between Mars and the next planet, which is Jupiter, there's actually a big gap, and I'm going to talk about what's in that gap presently. But let's go straight out to Jupiter. Jupiter is the biggest of the planets. It doesn't look like the biggest of the planets because Saturn with its rings actually is wider than Jupiter. But Jupiter as mass has more mass than the rest of the planets put together. So here is Jupiter with its great red spot, a persistent storm that has been on Jupiter for more than 300 years. It was spotted with the very first telescopes and it's still there. And in fact, you can see in the background one of its moons. It has multiple moons, four of which are big enough to easily see from the Earth. And so that happens to be, check my notes here, that's Ganymede, which is the outermost of the four Jovian moons. Here is Ganymede, up close. Man, that looks like kind of a mess. Of the four Jovian moons, the most interesting one is coming up. It's not Ganymede, and it's actually not Callisto either. This is the third one in. The most interesting one, from our perspective actually, is this one. This is Europa. The reason Europa is quite interesting is because, although we haven't landed anything there yet, we believe it's covered with ice, water ice. And not only covered with ice, but it has an ocean of liquid water underneath the ice. The only place in the solar system we currently believe that there is lots of liquid water present besides on the Earth. There are maybe forms of life that don't depend on liquid water. But we don't know of any, pretty much, because that seems to be very central to all forms of life on this planet. If we're going to look for life, this might be one place to look. Mars might be a place to look for fossils, because Mars used to have lots of liquid water, and one of the big mysteries of the present time is, what happened to all the water on Mars? Mars does not have any liquid water anymore, but Mars has huge canyons, bigger canyons than are on the Earth, carved by running water. But there's no running water there anymore. Not clear what happened. Something kind of went wrong with Mars, too.
James, how big is Europa compared to Earth and Mars?
I will show you, actually, momentarily, a slide that has a bunch of moons and has the Earth and has our moon and whatever. You will see. Europa is a big place, but it's not as big as Mars. Mars is a planet. Europa is a moon of another planet. And then there's Io. This is kind of a close-up of Io. Io is a nasty place. Man alive. Okay? Sulfur, volcanoes, plumes, continuous volcanism, plumes hundreds of kilometers into the air. In fact, people were totally shocked when they got close to Io and realized Io is so close to Jupiter that it gets stretched back and forth, and so it's just continuously erupting because it can't cool, it can't ever solidify, in some sense. So here, for instance, this is a montage, but it's an appropriate one showing Jupiter and Io, and what you can see, actually, is you can see a plume. This is an actual photograph of Io. Okay, that is a plume of a volcano that is erupting so high above the surface that you can actually see it over the edge of the planet, or the moon. Okay? So Io is a very dramatic place if you're looking for volcanoes. The moon had volcanoes, Mars had volcanoes, Venus has lots of volcanoes, mostly not active. Io, it never stopped. Saturn. Favorite planet of many people, including myself, excepting for Earth, of course. This is a very interesting photograph of Saturn. It's taken within the shadow. So in other words, it's taken looking at Saturn back towards the direction of the sun. And it can that means that they could actually bring out certain features of the planet. This was taken with the, gosh, I'm blanking right now. The Huygens spacecraft, and who dropped it off? I'll get back to that. Okay, one thing I like about this particular photograph, though, is that in the photograph, as is typical, you can see background objects, including background stars, but since we're looking back toward the sun is behind the planet, you can actually see the inner planets. That is Earth. That is Earth 1 billion miles away.
Can you show that again? Yeah.
That is Earth, right there. Seen from Saturn, looking back towards Earth.
Wow.
Very typically, astronomers, when they take pictures of things, they may do so in various wavelengths, and then they choose a color set so as to show out features. And so often, objects that you see in astronomical photographs are more colorful than they appear when you look. There's a variety of reasons for that, not the least of which is our eyes are really lousy at color, especially when the light is low level. Okay? So you can do much better with cameras. And so this is a false color image, but it shows some very interesting things of Saturn. You can actually see northern and southern lights on Saturn. Aurora, just like we have here on Earth. Okay? Although not in this photo. So the rings of Saturn are the most magnificent of all the rings in the solar system, but there are lots of rings in the solar system. Jupiter has rings, Saturn, of course, Uranus has rings, Neptune has rings, but nothing like these. And the rings are, we've now been there and looked them over, and the more we look them over, the more amazing they are.
What are they, dust?
The rings of Saturn are mostly small particles of things like dust, but ice, more ice than dust in the case. Okay. Which is part of the reason they're so bright and visible, is because they reflect the light very well. And there are little moons that shepherd the rings and keep the ice in its place. And so basically when you see that little gap there, that's because there's a moon that's keeping the dust and the ice out of that gap. So it turns out that Saturn tips back and forth as viewed from Earth. It goes through seasons, just like the Earth goes through seasons. So upon occasion, in fact this was quite mysterious when Galileo was using his telescope, he couldn't quite make out the rings. He could just see that this was an elongated object. But then, some time later, he noticed that it wasn't an elongated object anymore. And what had happened was that he was looking at Saturn when the rings were just about edge-on to Earth, close to this. And then the rings, you can't see them well at all, because they're so thin. Basically, these rings extend as far as is the distance from the Earth to the Moon, and yet they're only a kilometer thick. So if they were the size of a piece of paper, they would be much thinner than the paper. The width to the depth is tremendously thin. So here's a series of photographs taken from the Earth over many years showing the seasons, essentially, of Saturn. Out from Saturn is Uranus. Uranus is interesting because it's tipped. Almost everything in the solar system orbits in the plane, and the moons are in the plane, and the rings are in the plane, and Uranus is not. This essentially means that at some point Uranus suffered a tremendous impact. This is our belief, that sent material into its orbit and it tipped it over, literally, on its side, and now it has a ring system, but its ring system is on its side. This has an interesting consequence, and that is that one end of Uranus points toward the Sun, and then halfway around in its orbit, the other end. And so this thing will have 40 years of daytime, and then 40 years of nighttime. Not necessarily exactly where you'd want to live, but. Here's Neptune. Neptune has rings, but they're difficult to spot. It has a lot of methane in the atmosphere, which makes it look blue, but that's not a surface. These are gas giants. They do have solid surfaces, but they're deep, deep, deep within. We'll never get anywhere close to those solid surfaces. We have to deal with the atmosphere. And we have dropped probes into the atmosphere of Jupiter, and we will drop some probes into Saturn, and we've dropped probes into the atmospheres of some of the moons, and I'll show you the moons momentarily. Despite being demoted, this is Pluto.
Pluto is a planet.
Pluto is a minor planet, and I'll explain why in a moment, but it turns out that Pluto has multiple moons, and so this is Pluto with its main moon, Charon, and two other moons, Hydra and Nix, and we are sending a spacecraft in that direction. It's going to fly by in 2014. It's been on its way already for about 6 years. It takes a long time to get to Pluto. And it's not going to stop there. It's going to go right on by. But we'll get some good photographs of Pluto relatively soon, as in within a few years. So here are some selected moons. Now back to your question, how big are these things? So if this is the Earth, okay, our moon is relatively large compared to us. I mean, Pluto and Charon actually is sort of similar, a big moon compared to the size of the planet. Now take a look. Here are the moons of Jupiter. And so you'll see that the moons of Jupiter, Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, Io, they're all very big, similar in size perhaps to our moon. It turns out that Saturn has one very large moon, Titan. Okay? Neptune has one very large moon, Triton. And then, well, you can kind of look. For instance, anybody want to tell me where these names come from?
Oh, Shakespeare.
Yeah, these are all named after characters in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Okay, for instance, these are referred to as the Jovian Galilean moons, because Galileo was the first one to pick up on them. It turns out that Mars has two moons, and on this scale, you can't even see them. They're very tiny. Okay? So, a little bit. These are not all the moons in the solar system, some selected moons of planets. And in fact, turns out, we'll see a picture in a moment, of the asteroid Ida, which has a moon, but too small to be seen. And I'm going to show you Eris in a moment, which is now. Here is why Pluto got demoted. It turned out that somebody found something in about the same place of the solar system that was bigger than Pluto. Pluto isn't even the biggest thing out there. And so then, well, okay, so now we have, maybe we have 10. And then people found another one that was just about as big as Pluto. Now we have 11. At some point, you've got to say, either we're going to continue listing more and more and more planets, or we're going to just draw the line. And if we draw the line, what kind of line should we draw? So, the decision was made by the Astronomical Society of the South Pacific or something like that. I'm not an astronomer, remember? Okay. To say that you don't call it a planet unless it controls its neighborhood. In other words, it needs to be the dominant object in its orbit, in its part of the solar system. And so there's nothing else near Mercury, although we've looked. People thought for a while there was a planet called Vulcan, and we looked really hard, and there is no planet called Vulcan. It's not there. Okay? But it turns out that Pluto does not dominate. Outside of Neptune, there's an entire belt called the Kuiper Belt, and this belt is filled with thousands of things, and some of them probably are even bigger than these ones. But we've actually found one that's bigger than Pluto. Pluto is a big one, no doubt. But here's a whole series of other things that have been discovered, and many of them have their own moons. So we're going to call them minor planets rather than calling Pluto a planet anymore. Too bad. Okay, let's check my time here. I got some time stamps. I'm going to pick up the pace here a little bit. Okay, so this is what the planets look like compared to the Sun. So just like I had the Earth as a scale for some of those moons and some of those minor planets, here's the Sun as a scale, and you'll notice that Jupiter is big, Saturn is almost as big, but very lightweight, relatively speaking. Okay, so here we have Uranus and Neptune, there's Earth and Venus, which are very similar in size, and then down from there, Mars, Mercury, many moons, almost an afterthought in the grand scheme of things. Let's talk about the other things that orbit the Sun. We're still in the solar system. We will be for a little while yet. Comets. Comets are big chunks of mostly ice and dust, and as they get close to the Sun, they start to boil off, and they leave these tremendous tails behind them. This is Comet McNaught. This is also Comet McNaught. Basically, the tails can change as time goes by. Some of you may remember Comet Hale-Bopp. You may or may not have ever encountered or heard of Comet Ikea-Zeng, and then Comet Ikea-Seki. It turns out that you name comets after the people who first noticed them, and apparently Ikea was good at it. So here is, and you may have heard of some of these comets. Comet Hayakutake from some years ago. This is Swift-Tuttle. If I remember correctly, I believe Swift-Tuttle is the source of the material that we run through. The Earth goes through every year a ring of material, and it produces a meteor shower. And I think Swift-Tuttle is the source of the Perseid meteor shower, which is going to peak on the 12th of August, so just around the corner. We have sent spacecraft to comets, a few of them. So this happens to be what it looks like when you get close to the nucleus and you see all of this ice and boiling and stuff like that. Okay, so this happens to be Hartley 2, but more famous than that, this is Halley's Comet. So Halley's Comet has been around, well, since before Halley's day. He was the one who noticed the pattern and figured out. And the last time it came by in 1986, if I remember correctly, it was kind of a letdown. It was not that exciting.
When's the next one?
Well, the period of Halley's Comet is 76 years, okay, almost 80 years. So it'll be back. We may or may not be around. Our kids should be, our grandkids for sure. Okay, and we'll see whether or not it's more spectacular the next time it comes around. Many comets only go around more or less one time. Many comets strike the sun. Okay, they don't go around even one time. They just come in, fall in the sun. There was a comet recently that it went so close to the sun that the sun ripped its tail off. And the tail came off in one direction and the nucleus came off in another direction and regrew its tail and off it went. It'll be back in 500 years or so. That was called Comet Lovejoy. One of the most famous comets recently was Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. So apparently Shoemaker-Levy, as a team, were pretty good at finding comets too. This one was a particularly cool comet because it came close to Jupiter and got broken into pieces. So people talk about the string of pearls. And then these pieces went around, and the next time around, they hit Jupiter. And unfortunately, they hit the far side of Jupiter, but when Jupiter rotated, this is what it looked like. Those are impact marks in the atmosphere of Jupiter from those cometary fragments. So, had any of things like that struck the Earth, even if you hadn't been nearby, you would have noticed, because that was a tremendous release of energy. Okay, here we go. Besides comets, comets have a tendency to be outside of the orbits of all the planets. And occasionally they interact with each other and they sort of by mistake fall in toward the sun, and then they end up in very elongated orbits, and so they come close to the sun and then far away and then close, and often it takes many, many years for them to ever come back. So a given person will typically see a given comet maybe only once. Okay. Asteroids, on the other hand, are just chunks of rock, and they have a tendency to orbit in the vicinity of the planets. In some sense, you might even say the asteroids are planets that didn't quite get their act together. So here is a chunk. This chunk is Eros, and here is Ida, and Ida happens to have its own little tiny moon, which was a total surprise. There's Dactyl. So by noticing the orbital period of Dactyl, you can actually figure out what is the mass of this object, and so we learned a lot. These were taken by flybys of spacecraft heading through the asteroid belt on the way out, and they passed some asteroids and took pictures of them. So what I'd like to do now is show you another video clip. What this video clip is it shows you, I'm just going to get it started here, and then I'll talk about what it means. So essentially, this is the sun in the middle, and then you can see that's Mercury going around it. Mercury has a kind of an elongated orbit, so it goes faster and slower. Outside of Mercury comes Venus, so there's Venus going around. Here's Earth going around. Oh, there, Earth going around there. And then outside of Earth is Mars. And then outside of Mars, quite a ways outside of Mars, is Jupiter, and you'll see Jupiter once in a while. It's not always even on the screen. Now, what's going on here is those little dots indicate asteroids as people discover them. And you'll notice that the asteroids in general, they first make them bright, okay? So the dots are bright, and then they ease up and they leave them on the screen, but they're kind of dim. I'm going to turn the lights down even more so we can maybe start to see the little dim asteroids. And this is a counter. So this thing is running from the 1980. So now it's 1989, and we are now tracking 14,000 asteroids. You'll notice that the asteroids in general are discovered outside of the Earth. So the idea is the nighttime side is this side, right? Away from the sun. And so presumably as people discover asteroids, they discover them in the nighttime sky. Once they're discovered, then they remain. And so this thing, as it runs, we're up to 1992. This is going to run to 2012, so we're about halfway through this clip. There goes Jupiter. Notice that many of the asteroids are in between Jupiter and Mars. And you'll notice there will be these big spikes of discovery where a whole bunch of asteroids were noticed all at the same time. Some of the asteroids are colored red. I'm colorblind, so I can't actually see any, but that's just my problem. The red-colored ones are the ones that actually cross the orbit of the Earth. So those are the ones that could potentially impact the Earth at some point. The ones that are green presumably are basically safe unless they happen to interact with each other and get put off course. Okay, so we're reaching the year 2000, and as the years go by, we get better and better techniques for discovering asteroids, and it gets scary. We're at 125,000 so far. Okay, we're at 180,000 asteroids. You'll notice that actually, every once in a while, you'll even start to discover asteroids that aren't even in the night sky, which is really scary. Okay, those were actually discovered from spacecraft that don't need to look in the night sky exclusively. Okay, so here we are, 275,000 asteroids and counting. There's a lot of space out there, so it's not quite this crowded, but in actuality, each of those dots indicates an asteroid, which we are now tracking and we know about. And you'll notice that there is really a belt, an asteroid belt between the orbit of Jupiter and the orbit of Mars, almost as if the stuff in the solar system just never quite got its act together. Our understanding, our belief, there's kind of a theme here, and that is that things have a tendency to swirl around. And you'll see lots of swirls at the galactic level, you'll see swirls at the solar system level. Okay, but swirls are related to the basic physics, and so we believe that, okay, 540,000, oh man, my computer is too much. Keep up. So, let me turn some lights back on here.
Is that real or is that simulated?
That was actually plotting what is real. So, in some sense, that is not simulated. We didn't make that up. Okay, that is really what's out there as far as asteroids. And those are only the ones that we had found as of 2010, and, well, that was a couple of years ago, so we know of more than that by now.
But it wasn't taken from a camera a billion miles out.
That would have been very cool. No, these were all asteroids discovered from the Earth, or from satellites mostly, which were in orbit of the Earth. Okay.
A lot of them in the Earth's orbit there.
Right? It turns out that there are a fair number that do go in and out. But these are all predictable in fact how they move, and so people will sometimes be doing calculations, oh yes, maybe, and the key is to pick up on the possibility of something getting close to the Earth a few orbits in advance so that you can think about what to do about it. Of course, you know, as of 100 years ago, we couldn't do anything about it, and things do strike the Earth sometimes, and things sneak up on us sometimes too, but it's possible, maybe even in our lifetimes, that somebody will calculate that a specific asteroid is likely to strike the Earth, and that we will, as Earth, do something about it. Send something to intercept the asteroid and deflect it in some sense. We can do that. We have not tried yet.
And we probably argue about it. No, it's not going to happen. Or yes, it's going to happen. And we'll just argue about it.
It's the ones that sneak up on us that worry me the most. Even in the last 10 years or whatever, I've heard a few reports of big, huge fireballs in the sky, and people say, oh yeah, that was an asteroid. Oops, I missed that one. Okay. Now, in a few minutes that remain, so definitely not an even-handed approach to the universe here, but let's talk about stars and configurations of stars. So, from the Earth, with a telescope, this is what you might see. This happens to be the stars in the direction of the constellation Orion. So there's the belt of Orion, there's Orion's nebula, there's Rigel, there's Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is a huge star. Betelgeuse, if it was at the location of our sun, would extend out to Jupiter. That's how big that star is. Okay. Our star is very average. Very average. Okay. So, as you look around with telescopes and with long-time exposures, you will see clouds of dust, clouds of gas, more gas than dust. Okay. So these are stellar nurseries. This one happens to be called Mystic Mountain. Sounds like an amusement park. Okay. So you'll see stars in these images, and then you'll see places. These are star-forming regions. The ones that are dark tend to be dust. The ones that are glowing tend to be gas. And the reason they glow is because often there have been collapses and formation of stars, and then that radiation from those stars makes the dust around them glow. Sometimes they look sort of familiar. This is called the Horsehead Nebula, just because it happens to look kind of like a horse head. These are referred to as the pillars of creation. Now, I just want to give you a little tiny context as far as size. There are, within this photograph, a bunch of places where there have been sort of collapses of the dust, possibly to form something like a star. Maybe it's not formed just yet. Okay? So, I mean, take a look at that one there, right? Little tiny things, these little knots. That is bigger than the solar system. This is a huge object. Okay, that little knot there, that's what the solar system used to be, a knot in a huge cloud of dust and gas. And it collapsed, and now we have a solar system. Okay, and so these are dramatically large structures. Typically then, sometimes hidden within the structures, and not available to visible light, but we can see them otherwise, will be bright, young stars.
Have they mapped the direction of which, like, where that's collapsing? Like, is that one currently in the state of shrinking back together, or is it expanding?
Well, actually, both at the same time. This is the funny thing, is you get these big clouds of dust, and there's so little gravity that they don't necessarily do very much.
Right.
And then if you have some sort of a stellar explosion nearby, you can send a shockwave through it and start a collapse. But the shockwaves have a tendency to push the material around as well. And then if you get a star, that star will blow the material away from itself. So the trick is to get enough material to start the star burning before you blow the rest of the material away. And so these are turbulent, but they're turbulent on long time scales. Okay, and so is this collapsing? Yes. Is it expanding? Actually, it's doing that too. Where? I'm not 100% sure where is which. But these things are dynamic, but they're not dynamic on a human time scale. So if you look at this tomorrow or next year or next, you know, millennium, next millennium you might start to see some changes to it. These things are light years apart, though, or light years across. So it takes a long time to change the structure that is that big. Jumping actually very quickly from stellar nurseries where stars are born to how stars die. This happens to be a supermassive star called Eta Carinae, which exploded, and it survived the explosion. Stars have a tendency to explode many times. And so this is one of the biggest explosions that didn't actually completely destroy the star. The big ones that destroy the star are called supernova, and they often leave only a tiny remnant. This star is mostly still there. So this explosion actually reached the Earth, the light from this explosion, in the 1830s. Mm-hmm. And this is how big it looks now. And this star is still there, and it's going to explode a few more times before it's done. Here's the Helix Nebula. And so the Helix Nebula, it's called a planetary nebula because it looks a bit like a planet if you don't have a good enough telescope. It doesn't have anything to do with a planet. It's actually an exploding star. You can see the star in the middle, and it has exploded and sent out some of its outer layers, and so it's shedding mass as it gets close to the end of its life. This one is very cool. This is the Cat Eye Nebula, and you can see these concentric rings. Each of those is in a new explosion, and then it takes some time, and then explodes again, it takes some time, and explodes again, and you end up with this very complicated pattern in the middle. But if you look toward the outside, you'll see these more or less concentric rings indicated explosions, and those fronts are moving outwards and outwards.
And is there a guess as to what the time span is of each explosion?
I don't remember the number, but yes, I think those are known to be maybe 10,000 years apart or something like that. Something fairly specific. Okay. So these are nebulae. Here is, in fact, the crab supernova remnant. So this actually is what's left of a big star that exploded that pretty much is gone. The only thing that's left in here is a rapidly rotating object, a pulsar. We know it's there because it happens to have a strong enough magnetic field that it sends out waves to us, and those waves tell us how fast it's rotating. This one's a relatively slowly rotating pulsar. It only goes around 30 times a second. There are ones that go around 1,000 times a second. Okay. So basically, this object, the star, is pretty much gone. This tiny rotating object that's left over, the pulsar, is rapidly spinning.
What do you mean by tiny?
Yeah.
Tiny, okay. So tiny is in the size of this valley. Okay, it's not the size of a star, it's not even the size of the Earth. It's on the order of a few miles across. Okay? And it's essentially solid nuclear material.
And it's in the center of that?
Yes, we can actually see it. I don't remember where to look for it, but the funny thing is, to get this particular exposure, you have to have a very long time exposure to get this picture. But to see this flashing on and off, you have to have a really short time exposure. So people didn't know this pulsar for a long time. Okay? But you can actually take pictures of this crab nebula. And actually, if you take them fast enough, like once per 1,000th of a second, you'll actually see this thing get brighter and get dimmer and get brighter and get dimmer 30 times every second. And the idea is it's like a lighthouse, and the lighthouse is swinging around, and it just swings around and points towards us every time it goes around. And it goes on really fast. Okay? There's a limit. Basically, if you take a compressed object and push it past about 1.4 times the mass of the sun, even the nuclear structure can't prevent it from collapsing. And then it will collapse. We don't understand what it collapses into. We have a name for it. We call it a black hole. A black hole just means an area in which there is material, and even light can't escape from that area. And so the edge of the black hole is not actually the edge of the object that's within the black hole. But this is not a black hole, this is a pulsar.
What's the size scale?
I don't have it memorized. This thing was noticed at the Earth. This was a very bright explosion. It was noticed in 1066, I think. Okay, and so now this is many light years across. This has been expanding since for 1,000 years. Okay, but I don't remember. I can look that up for you. Okay, groups of stars. This happens to be the Pleiades. It's the one Japanese word I know. Subaru. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the name of this set of stars, the Pleiades. Okay, and it turns out, this is a little bit misleading. Typically when stars are young, they look bright, they look blue, okay? These stars actually look, kind of look blue. They're young stars, so they look blue and they have dust around them because they happen to be floating through a gas cloud. It's not actually the gas that formed the stars that is there. This is particularly beautiful. This is called the Starburst Cluster, another cluster of stars formed from the gases around them, and they've now basically blown that gas away and are burning brightly. Globular clusters. Groups of stars, 100,000 stars, maybe more. Hopefully, if you come out and look through telescopes with me tomorrow night, if it's clear, we will see at least one. Okay, so globular clusters tend to be groups of stars, very ancient stars in general, and they are oriented kind of in spheres around galaxies, which help us figure out where the middle of the galaxies are. If you look deep into a globular cluster, this is what you see. This happens to be a globular cluster in the direction of Hercules. It's not in Hercules. Hercules is a set of stars near us. In the direction of Hercules, you can see, and at the center of this, the stars are very dense.
In a cluster like that, how close might typical stars be to one another?
Okay, so where we are located, we're kind of in the outskirts of the Milky Way. This is what the Milky Way looks like. Okay, and so stars around here, the nearest star is about 4 light-years away. So it takes light about 4 years. That's a long ways. It turns out that stars in the center of a galaxy or in the center of a globular cluster can be tenths of light years apart. So they're not touching, and nothing like that. They're much, much, much closer. Not nearly as close as the solar system, nothing like that either, but much, much, much closer. The solar system is 20 light minutes across, okay? And you have to go light years before you find another star. But in these vicinities, you could imagine putting another star just outside the solar system, and it would have its own solar system, essentially. Most stars actually come in pairs, or more than pairs, and most stars have planets, too. So this is what the Milky Way looks like. There's lots of dust and there's lots of gas, so it turns out it's hard to figure out where the middle is unless you can spot the globular clusters. And if you see that the globular clusters form a ring right around here, then you say, aha, that means the middle of the Milky Way is right about there. Okay? So if I look in that direction, this is what I see. Not that much. And the reason is there's so much dust in that direction that I can't see very deeply. But that is where the center of the Milky Way is located, in that direction. And you can see the center, but not in visible light. You need to be looking at infrared, okay? However, there are certain places nearby, especially right here, you can actually see pretty deeply. This is in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. And so if you look into some of these windows, you can pretty much look almost all the way to the center of our Milky Way, and this is what you'll see. This is the Sagittarius star cloud. And you can actually see stars that are rotating around a very massive invisible object. There is a black hole in the center of our galaxy. There's a black hole in the center of most galaxies. And this is not just any old black hole. This is like a billion solar mass black hole. Big, massive black hole. Here are a couple galaxies. These are the Magellanic Clouds, which are satellites to our own. We are part of a group of about 40 galaxies, and each galaxy has billions of stars, maybe as many as 100 billion. This is Andromeda, which is the other Milky Way, Andromeda, and one other spiral are the three biggest parts of this local group. And Andromeda itself has several of its own little satellite galaxies. This is called the Whirlpool Galaxy, which is a very nice flat-on view of a spiral galaxy. This is a particularly neat photograph. This is the Sombrero Galaxy, which is a spiral, but we're seeing it almost edge-on, and you see a lot of dust, because the dust is in the plane of the galaxy. So when you see a photograph like this, typically, the dots here, you have to decide, are these local stars or are these distant galaxies? Okay, and so any dot that has a spikes like that, that's definitely a local star. But many of these things there, what's that? That's definitely a spiral galaxy in the distance. And so what people tend to do if they want to look for other galaxies is they look in directions that are not in the plane of our own galaxy, because you'll see too many stars and too much dust. And if you look in the not the plane of our own galaxy, you will generally see more galaxies than you will see stars. And so our current belief is there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, approximately, and 100 billion galaxies. Sometimes spiral galaxies have a big bar across the middle, so this is called a barred spiral. Sometimes galaxies just don't have much structure, so this is called an elliptical. We don't fully understand how galaxies evolve into these various shapes. The current belief is that when galaxies eat each other, they lose their structure and end up elliptical. So for instance, here are two galaxies who are trying hard to eat each other. Galaxy collisions, oddly enough, since stars are so far separated, they can destroy each other as far as their structure, although very typically star-on-star collisions are unlikely even when two galaxies collide. But the structure of the galaxy may disappear. And here, for instance, the Tadpole Galaxy, somebody really got mangled in that one. And in this particular case, that's a galaxy, that's a galaxy, that's a galaxy, that's a galaxy. These are all galaxies in the background. Very few stars in this picture. I see one right here, I see one right here, and that's about it. Okay, this is almost all galaxies in this photograph. One thing you can do if you take a picture that's deep enough is you can actually start to see streaks. These streaks are not anomalies of the optical system of your telescope. These streaks are actually because there are distant galaxies behind this central mass, and the light from that galaxy that's hidden back there is being bent. These are gravitational lensing events. And so you can actually see galaxies which are smeared out, badly distorted, and you'll see multiple versions of the same galaxy. If you look at this light, and then you look at this light up here, and look at this light up here, you'll realize after a while, wait a minute, that's the same light from the same galaxy. It has the same features, but the galaxy is badly distorted because of the mass of something in the foreground. So this is called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. A few years ago, they came up with the Hubble Deep Field image. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field image. That's a star. That's it. Everything else in this picture is a galaxy. And frankly, the fainter they are, probably they're not smaller, they're just farther away. And by looking at what they look like when they're far away compared to the ones that are nearby, the ones that are far away, the light has taken maybe 8 or 10 or 12 billion years to reach us. So that means what it looked like 8 or 10 or 12 billion years ago. This, on the other hand, that's what it looked like, you know, only 250 million years ago. So then you could say, okay, well, this is what galaxies look like now, and that's what those galaxies probably do look like now, but back a long time ago, galaxies looked different. And in fact, old ancient galaxies do look different than current galaxies. Okay, so let's see, how's my time? Oh, not too bad. I have one more short video clip, and then I'm down to my last two provocative slides. So this is about 3 minutes worth of a video clip talking about how you might move from the Earth towards the Virgo cluster of galaxies. I show this, my computer can't quite keep up, I apologize, but it gives you an idea of the three-dimensional nature of all these pictures, which we've kind of missed in the pictures I've shown you today. So I'm going to jump forward to about here we go.
Facing this familiar constellation, Orion, the Milky Way arcs to the left of Orion. As we fly toward the sword hanging below Orion's belt, the sword comes apart because all the stars making up the sword are at different distances. We see that the center of the sword is the Orion Nebula, a gas cloud illuminated by the young stars forming there. Now, as we pass the Horsehead Nebula, we're 1,500 light years from Earth. The next glowing gas cloud that we see is another stellar nursery, the Rosette Nebula. Not all these glowing nebulae are stellar birthplaces. This is a place where a star died. It was seen on Earth about 1,000 years ago. This is the remnant of the Crab supernova. And you can see the neutron star at its center blinking 30 times a second. Until now, we've been inside the disk of the Milky Way, where our view of the center is blocked by dust created by explosions like the Crab Nebula. So let's rise up and out of the disk so that we can see the magnificent panorama of a galaxy like our own. As the galaxy recedes into the distance with the large and small nebulae and clouds and other satellite galaxies, everything we see now is a galaxy. What's now come into view is the great galaxy in Andromeda, and in the foreground, a smaller spiral galaxy, Triangulum, or M33. As we go through this glowing gas cloud in M33, we're 2 million light years from home. Our goal in this voyage is the Virgo cluster, just coming into view on the left. So we're going to take a scenic route past some of the prettiest nearby galaxies that can be seen with an amateur telescope. Now, I hope you can see that there's a chain of galaxies that ends here at the Virgo cluster, and in fact, there are several such chains of galaxies that meet at the Virgo cluster. We're entering this chain here in the Ursa Major group of galaxies. We're going to ride down it toward the Virgo cluster. Before we were seeing largely spiral galaxies, but now we're starting to see big balls of stars, elliptical galaxies. This voyage ends at this large elliptical galaxy at the center of the Virgo cluster, M87, astronomers call it. There's a jet coming out of the center, and in the center, there's a gigantic black hole with a mass 3 billion times the mass of our sun.
Sorry, Scott, but we can't show that during the night time. Okay, I'm going to close. I have a couple minutes left here with two more slides. The first of which is I struggled, I have to admit, with the theme. Where the river flows, life abounds. Didn't quite know what to do with that one. But it turns out that life, especially life based on water, the existence of water in liquid form, okay, we seek that out, and we have pretty much convinced ourselves, we have convinced ourselves, that there is water in not liquid form on the moon. There is water on Mars, okay, not very much, not as much as there used to be. And we believe there's water in Europa. So, here is maybe sort of a river of sorts, trying to look for life. Life clearly on this planet, maybe life, maybe in the past at least, on Mars, there's Europa in the background, especially trying to follow what could be conceived as a river of sorts through space. So this is the closest I could get. Astrobiology, basically trying to understand whether or not there is biology available to us in the cosmos besides here. The final comment is, the title of this talk was The Visible Universe. In less than 60 minutes, I'm doing not too bad. If you know your physics and study how galaxies are structured and study how light bends around galaxies, you will come rather quickly to the realization that it doesn't pan out. There's not enough stuff there, visible, to account for the gravitational influences of galaxies on one another and of galaxies on light. And it's not off by a little bit. It's off by about a factor of 20. In other words, the visible universe is no more than 5% approximately of what's out there. So we have a name for the rest of it. We call it dark matter because we don't know what it is. We just know it's dark. It doesn't give off light, but it does have gravitational influences. Okay? And then, rather recently, people discovered that the universe is actually expanding because of a big bang long ago, okay? But it's actually picking up speed. It's expanding faster and faster. We don't understand that at all. So we give that another name. We call it dark energy. So in some sense, I've tried to talk about the visible universe, but I'll be the first to tell you that that's just the tip of a pretty big iceberg. And I guess that's what I had prepared. So thank you for